Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 14th of July. All things political is how we start off the week every Monday at 1 o'clock, and Joan Walsh is our guest this hour. Joan is editor-at-large of Salon, and she is an MSNBC commentator. She is an author of What's the Matter with White People? Finding Our Way in the Next America. She has Wisconsin ties, graduate of Shorewood High School, and went to UW-Madison. She's also a huge baseball fan, unfortunately for the San Francisco Giants, but we'll talk a wee bit of baseball, maybe at the top of the show. We have a lot to discuss this hour. We will look at the continuing crisis situation on the border and ask her what she thinks about the president deciding not to have pictures taken or have interaction with the many, many people who are on the border right now. It's a really complicated issue. How does she think the $3.7 billion, which the administration has asked for, should be distributed? There'll be a big fight about that money, certainly. We'll also be talking about the Republicans. This interesting poll today showing that two-thirds of Republicans think impeaching the president would be justified. She has written a recent piece titled Coward of the House, John Boehner's Pathetic Lawsuit Reveals His Weakness. She says never underestimate the cynicism of House Speaker John Boehner. We'll talk about health care reform and ask how it is going, looking at also the Supreme Court aftershocks, she describes them, of the Hobby Lobby earthquake. And we have a number of other things. Things are really bad in the Mideast. We'll talk about Israel and Palestine and if there's any possibility of a ceasefire in that part of the world and other issues as well. For you to join our conversation, as always, the phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hi, Joan.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. San Francisco Giants fan, will only spend a few minutes on this, but you find yourselves one game, I think, behind in your division. We're one game ahead as we go into the All-Star break. You have high hopes for the season.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I thought they were playing over their heads when they started off the season with the best record in baseball into early June. Then they cratered, and I don't think they are as bad as they've been since in the last month or so. They had a little bit of a resurgence over the weekend, taking two out of three from a weak team. So, I have high hopes. The Dodgers, we were very lucky that the Dodgers kind of they overtook us, and then they imploded too. So, neither team has really distinguished itself going into the All-Star break. So, I think we've got a good chance once they resume play.
You really are a baseball fan, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, I am.
Great.
Yes, I co-wrote a book on the opening of AT&T Park back in 2001. So, yeah, I'm a really serious baseball fan.
Yeah.
Love the Brewers. Love the Brewers when I lived there. I guess I'm a little fickle, but I've been in San Francisco for almost 30 years, so.
It's all right. You could be a fan of both. Just see how the season plays out. Let's go to the border.
Yeah.
People will be surprised who said this, but I was reading today this quote, through no fault of their own, they are caught in political crossfire. Anyone left or right seeking political gain at the expense of these desperate, vulnerable, poor, and suffering people are reprehensible. Taking a position deadly to his career, Glenn Beck, of all people.
Well, you know, every once in a while, Glenn Beck goes out there. I'm not sure he's a moral avatar, but it really might help dial back some of the extremism on this issue. You know, we saw the people in Murrieta, California, greeting children with epithets and violence and threats of violence. We've seen some really ugly scenes on the border. We've also seen some wonderful scenes where, you know, people, Americans have reached out to help. So, I think that the political situation is getting a little bit more balanced, but this is a problem that is long in the making. It not to point fingers at anybody, but you know, it stems from a law that was passed under President Bush with bipartisan support back at a time when we had bipartisan support for things like this, and it's going to take a bipartisan solution to gradually resolve it. And it's going to be gradual, Kathleen, because there's no, you know, changing the conditions in these countries overnight, and there's no getting out the message that you can't stay here either overnight. So it's really complicated.
Yeah. You wrote a piece last week urging the president to talk with some of these people who are trying to get into the country to see firsthand the humanitarian and immigration crisis amassing there. He chose not to do that. Why do you think he made that decision?
You know, I understand it, and I think I'm sure that he and his staff felt that it was a no-win situation for him. You know, on his left, maybe it's not a left-right thing, but, you know, in parts of his base, this is clearly a refugee issue, and, you know, there's talk of trying to send people back or send them back quicker or expedite immigration hearings or deportation proceedings. People are horrified, and if you really showed him with the children, some of the scenes that we, you know, on television already are heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
If he tried to be tough about it, then, you know, his base wouldn't forgive him. On the right, you know, unless he was pictured, you know, packing kids into buses to go home, it would look as though he were recruiting people to come here, which is already what, you know, the more extremist voices think. However, you know, the reason I wrote what I did and I stand by it is I do think that this is a problem of, you know, long in the making, that's going to be long in the solving, and that, you know, a careful meetings with people, some of them, you know, televised, I think would have brought home to Americans that this is not a simple issue, and this is something that, yes, we can argue about it, we can fight over it, but that we've got to put together a long-term solution, because the conditions in these countries that are driving these kids and in some cases their parents, but many of them unaccompanied kids, these things have been coming a long time. This violence, this drug-fueled violence, is not going to be solved overnight.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it was a kind of leadership that would, you know, point out to Americans that we all have a stake in coming to some kind of solution.
Mm-hmm.
But he disagreed with me, Kathleen, so what are you going to do?
What are you going to do? Tell him again. I can't get some of the images out of my mind. I don't know what channel it was on over the weekend, but there was this just lovely 7-year-old girl who was traveling by herself. She had everything she owned in a plastic bag, which was probably 4 things. They asked her, "Where are you going?" And she thought she lost the piece of paper that had what state her mother was in, and she found it. It was in her back pocket, and she pulled it out and said, "North Carolina. My mother is in North Carolina," she said in Spanish. And I thought, oh, my goodness. You know, if you just look at the faces, and there are so many of these young people, what's going to happen to her? She's all by herself. She's 7 years old with nobody.
Yeah, it's really tragic, and a lot of them are that young. And, you know, it's easy for us to say that their family members should not be sending them here. But, you know, with the violence that they faced in Honduras and El Salvador and to some extent in Guatemala, these family members think, you know, I saw a mother quoted who sent her child away and said, "I'd rather have them die trying to get to this country than have them die here, because that's their certain fate." So, you know, I think it is heartbreaking. On the other hand, we can't say everyone should come because we'll find places for them. I don't think we have that capacity in this country either. So it's very tough.
I know the president and his staff have been meeting with different governors to ask for their support. It seems to me, Joan, is that this spirit of bitterness between the parties is so strong right now that I can't imagine everybody getting together and saying, we've got to figure out what our immigration policy is, and we have to figure out what a humanitarian response is at this moment. For heaven's sake, you would think of all issues that people would be able to come together and figure it out. And yet, I don't see that happening. Do you?
No, I really don't. I mean, I think they will come to some accommodation on the budget request. But, some governors are resisting the idea of being part of any kind of even temporary resettlement plan. And, you know, there's tension, too, because lots of, I mean, I think even some Democratic governors, John Hickenlooper, I think, in Colorado, I think has expressed a little bit of, you know, reticence, just because their budgets are strapped and, you know, people, there's a perception, a reality, actually, that, you know, our people need a lot of help. So, but it is mainly Republicans who have dragged their feet on this. And you know, you've got, to some extent, this is a failure of comprehensive immigration reform, which, again, used to be a bipartisan notion. But now you've got a lot of Republicans who have dug in their heels and said, you know, we're not going to be any part of a solution that leads to any kind of permanent, you know, pathway to citizenship for people who came illegally.
Mm-hmm.
And so a compromise that was actually reached against all odds in the Senate with 8 Republican votes fell apart in the House. There's no prayer of that passing the House. So it is tough to imagine a long-term solution.
Yeah. Well, speaking of finding it tough to find a long-term solution, let's go to the Mideast for a moment, where Hamas rockets are reaching beyond Tel Aviv. Israeli military has launched well over 1,000 airstrikes in the last week, and today downing a drone launched by Gaza militants. This is another part of the world. You think you make a little bit of progress, and then there, here you are again, back in the same situation we seem to have been in forever. Are you hopeful there can be at least a temporary ceasefire, to say nothing of the fact of a permanent solution to this?
I think there are so many forces that want some kind of temporary ceasefire. We'll probably see something, but, you know, we've just had so many years of betrayal on both sides, and you know, both sides have their litany of why the other can't be trusted. You know, it's one of those places I'm more despairing about even than bipartisan cooperation on immigration reform in our country. I'm sorry to say that, Kathleen, because I'm always an optimist, but this is a very, very tough one. But, you know, the kinds of damage, you know, that I don't want to be one-sided on this, but, you know, Israel does have Iron Dome with our help, not that it, you know, can protect everyone. And, you know, as you said in the broadcast leading up to this, we've seen a lot of civilian deaths in Gaza, and dozens of children have died, and mm-hmm. this is creating, you know, creating more hatred. So, you know, I hope there will be a ceasefire soon, but it continuously eludes a long-term solution, and several presidents have tried and failed.
And what happens with all of these attacks really on both sides is hardliners tend to take over and then forget any kind of compromise because you're really dug into whatever your position is.
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, I think we've had moments of hope, certainly under President Clinton. John Kerry went back at it recently, and, you know, I think that there's been somewhat more of an effort to be to return to the days of being a kind of honest broker between the two, and yet that still hasn't yielded much of an answer, and it's an area that is really, really very depressing to think about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. New York Times had a front page story yesterday on Governor Chris Christie setting fundraising records for national Republican groups focusing on governor's races in a number of states. What are your thoughts on that? Why they are able to get probably double the amount of money that Democrats are, and what it means for many states to be in Republican control, and if you imagine it will continue?
Well, I think it's very frightening, but they, you know, they represent, as we saw in Wisconsin, you know, they represent the interests of wealthy people, and therefore it's easier to raise money. I mean, Democrats, in my opinion, have tilted too far towards Wall Street, and that enabled them to rack up big campaign war chests. But, you know, as they've been somewhat more demanding with financial reform, they've lost their corner on Wall Street. Wall Street has tilted back to Republicans. So, you know, it's very tough. And even though Chris Christie is dogged his own presidential hopes, I think, are you know, certainly dogged and maybe doomed by his own home state scandals, he's got a magic touch and raises money really well for other governors. So, it's a little scary. The midterm elections are always tough for Democrats. And this year, you know, we hope, I speak as a Democrat, we hope that people learn the lessons of 2010 when a lot of Democrats stayed home. Because, you know, these state houses are where you see redistricting happening and you see these ridiculous lines drawn to benefit the party in power, which right now in a lot of places is Republican. So, you know, part of the reason Republicans in the House of Representatives could get 5 million fewer votes than Democrats in 2012 was that they controlled so many state houses, and they were able to redraw boundaries and, you know, concentrate Democrats and spread out Republicans and give them a better and sometimes unfair shot in a lot of states. So it really matters, but it's really tough for Democrats to get their voters out in these years.
Joan Walsh is our guest for All Things Political today. We'll still be talking about the Hobby Lobby decision and the female justices that Joan wrote about joining in a fierce dissent on another contraceptive case. We'll ask the question, which seems worth asking every now and then, how is healthcare reform doing? And we'll talk about, well, one of our listeners will bring up John Boehner. So feel free to join the conversation. Put us into new territory if you'd like, or respond to the issues that we've already brought forward. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Joan is editor-at-large for Salon. She is a commentator on MSNBC. She is the author of What's the Matter with White People? Finding Our Way in the Next America. She is a huge San Francisco Giants fan, and she co-wrote a book about the ballpark in 2001. She's also a Brewers fan. To your calls momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Two phone calls for All Things Political this hour with Joan Walsh, 800-486-8655. Pat in Milwaukee is our first caller. Joan, hi, Pat.
Hey, guys. Well, clearly, you know, Joan's coming from this from a very liberal point of view. And I think it's telling, you know, obviously she's on MSNBC a lot, and I wanted to get her comments on her colleague, Mark Halperin, I believe, over the weekend, was talking about the border crisis and basically said, you know, a lot of Democrats he's been talking to, Bob Woodward said the same thing on his Sunday show. They're even tiring of President Obama's lack of engagement and lack of leadership in just about every important issue of the day. And the fact of the matter is you can't ask for $4 billion from Congress and then in the same speech go on to politicize the issue and criticize everybody who you claim you want to work with to try and win elections in the midterm. And I think there's a lot of reality and a lot to be said in the fact that President Obama has done a lot of things that weren't necessarily honest. We can go all the way back from, you know, if you like your plan, you can keep it. That there is a lot of lack of trust for him. And I think it's well earned. And the fact is, if you talk to the Border Patrol, you know, there was a study that was released. They asked, why are all these kids coming? And all the people that they've talked to said, because they think they can stay. And that was the policy that the Obama administration put out. Yes, we need comprehensive immigration. But at the end of the day, right now, this isn't about comprehensive immigration. This is about securing the borders. And we can't simply let everybody into the country. It's unfortunate what's happening in those countries. But every country has fairly strict border regulations and an immigration policy, and we need to have the same thing in this country as well.
Joan?
Well, let's start with where we agree that, you know, we can't have open borders. We need a solid immigration policy. But the truth of the matter is these kids are coming and they're able to stay because of legislation passed under President Bush with plenty of Democratic support that declared them potentially refugees from violence. Now, it was set up mainly to protect kids who are victims of child sex trafficking, but it applies to these children as well. In terms of, you know, who started this and finger pointing about, you know, who mistrusted who and who mistreated who, I am a Democrat, and I do remember the president disappointing me as someone who is on the liberal side by working so hard to incorporate Republican objections into what became Obamacare, taking hundreds of Republican amendments, letting the process drag out while Senator Max Baucus of Montana worked with Chuck Grassley of Iowa and other Republicans to try to get them on board. The president has a long history that kind of culminated in feeling betrayed in 2011 when John Boehner walked away from a grand bargain to lift the debt ceiling. So, you know, I'm not going to deny that there are reasons for Republicans to distrust him, but I think that he came in trying to work across the aisle and, you know, leading Republicans, including poor Eric Cantor, who's now gone, and Newt Gingrich and a bunch of other people got together on the night he was inaugurated to talk about how if they stood firm and blocked everything that he tried to do, he'd fail. And that's been the Republican modus operandi since Inauguration Day. Make him fail, go back on ideas that you once supported, and make him be a one-term president. Now that he's been reelected, make him be a failure in the history books. So, you know, we have to disagree on that.
Thank you, Pat, for the call. Linda in Madison, hi.
Hi. My question is about the Hobby Lobby thing. Am I understanding this correctly? As an organization, they could give their employees any kind of health care they want, but when they, the way that they get prohibited is if they want to partake in the Affordable Health Care Act so that they can get their health care for their employees at like 50% off. Isn't that true?
I'm not sure I'm following you. Sorry.
Can you explain that? I'm not sure I'm following it either, Linda.
Yeah, I guess I thought that the only way that the government controls the health care that a corporation offers is if they use the Affordable Health Care Act, then they get their health care for their employees. They get, like, the government pays for half of it. Is that...
No, I'm sorry. That's not true. No, the government... Part of the Affordable Care Act was to stipulate that all insurance policies would have a floor of coverage, and it doesn't matter, you know, you participate in the Affordable Care Act merely by, you know, being a U.S. citizen and employing people in the United States. And so plans have to afford a basic level of coverage. And one of the things that they included as preventive coverage was contraception coverage. And so that's what it's about. You can't really, you can opt out and pay fines. There are ways to do that, but they're not, you know, getting money from the government to participate. These are regulations that apply to all insurance policies.
Joan, let's move into a perfect time to do this. You wrote recently, a few days after the Hobby Lobby decision, the court's three female justices joined in a fierce dissent on another contraceptive case. You say it underscored the tension and distrust that have split the court and the country. What was the other case?
Well, the other case was Christian College, Wheaton College, that asked that is also seeking to be exempt from the Affordable Care Act contraception mandate. But there are a few religious groups that are trying to do something really extraordinary, which is say, I mean, the administration has let them out of that those requirements, but they have to sign a form basically saying we don't want to participate. And Wheaton College, along with several other religious organizations, are saying that merely signing a form saying we, our conscience and our religious beliefs prohibit us from taking part in this program, merely signing that form violates their religious freedom. So what happened was they were granted, you know, temporary relief pending their case being heard. So they don't have to sign the form and they don't have to provide birth control while they wait for their case to wend its way through the courts. What the female justices objected to, however, was the fact that in this is really complicated and in the weeds. I'll do my best with this one,
okay.
Kathleen.
Sure.
But they argued that, Sonia Sotomayor argued, and the female justices concurred with her, that this is no longer a big question in the law because the Hobby Lobby decision, the silver lining of the Hobby Lobby decision was that by invoking the conscience clause, the government can step in. Women can still get their contraception covered with a workaround. And so Justice Alito said in his dissent that because companies or, well, it used to be religious organizations, now it's companies that claim that their conscience is being violated, when they sign that form and that waiver, the insurance company deals directly with the women, that is great. That's a sufficient accommodation. Women are not being denied anything. So the judges, the female judges felt like, hey, buddy, you just said that this conscience clause is working and is a functional part of the Affordable Care Act. Why are you granting them temporary relief from claims that they don't have anymore? And, you know, it reflects the fear of Justice Ginsburg and her dissent from the Hobby Lobby case, that Justice Alito was trying in his decision to argue that this is a very, 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 very narrow ruling. It wasn't really going to affect anything but birth control,
mm-hmm.
but that nothing in his decision could be really relied on by women. And so, you know, it was dispiriting to see the three women dissent so strongly.
Ken in Janesville is next. Hi, Ken. Ken, are you there? Hello. Call us back, Ken. Don't know where you are. Scott in Hudson. Hi.
Hi, yeah. Thanks for taking my phone
sure.
call. Sure. Really interesting program today. The question that I have has to do with our broken government being the result, to what extent, of our broken two-party system. A little bit of background. I was vetted amongst a handful of Democratic candidates to run against Sheila Harsdorf, state senator in the Hudson, Wisconsin area. Basically, even though I was told I gave the strongest performance and presented well, I was prevented by party leaders from that position because of my moderate pro-life position that I had that I take as an evangelical Christian. I'm a fiscal liberal. I'm a social conservative. And in an area that I live, you actually need a more socially conservative candidate in order to win. The Democrats would rather seemingly lose with a candidate who represents them more accurate, more purely than someone like myself. And I just see extremists in both parties setting the agenda to the far left and to the far right, and it's the moderates like myself that would actually make pretty strong candidates getting squeezed out. And it's my firm belief that you really can't govern from the far left or the far right, that you need to govern from the middle, and some of our best candidates have no shot whatsoever because they're not ideologues.
Joan, what do you think?
Well, it's hard for me to comment on local Wisconsin politics in a region I don't know much about. But, I think that the Democratic Party has evolved in more of a pro-choice direction. But you still have people like Pennsylvania Senator Bob Casey, who is anti-abortion. And you know, there are other people, other Democrats in the House. So I think that it is true that there's been more evolution and more people moving to the pro-choice side in the Democratic Party. There's no doubt about that.
So who strikes your fancy to be, even though it's a few years away, a couple of years away, to be the Democratic nominee? Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton, Elizabeth Warren, or other?
Oh, I think they're all good candidates. I think that, I love Elizabeth Warren. She said repeatedly she's not going to run. you know, I would like to see Hillary Clinton get a if she runs. She says she doesn't know, but everybody assumes she's running. I'm glad you put Joe Biden on that list because I don't think it's fair to leave him out. You know, he's a reliable liberal voice. People love him. He's going to Netroots Nation this weekend in Detroit. Speak to the Netroots, the party activists. That's kind of an interesting decision, and I think that's a way for the vice president to say to liberals, hey, don't count me out and stop talking only about, Hillary versus Elizabeth Warren. I'm still out here. So, I think Hillary Clinton would be very tough to beat if she did run, but I guess I'm agnostic. I'm not a Clinton hater at all. I supported her in 2008, in fact. But I'd be happy to see somebody emerge from the left to at least challenge her on some of these economic issues.
Now we'll go to Ken, I hope, in Janesville. Hi.
Hello. I would like to talk about the Boehner, Representative Boehner, suing the president. This is a coup d'etat. Guess what? We've become a banana republic.
You wrote about this recently, Joan.
Yes, I did. I'm not sure I would call it a coup d'etat, but I think I know where you're going with that. I mean, for one thing, our last Democratic president was impeached. It seems like Republicans have a hard time living with the results of elections for the White House when they don't go their way. And there are real questions here about whether Speaker Boehner has standing to even bring this suit. I think a lot of people believe that it's a kind of stunt, that it is trying to, channel the Obama hatred of the Republican base in a more productive direction than impeachment would. They seem to have gotten the memo that impeachment would be terrible for them politically in a year that they're expected to do pretty well. Impeachment would be a huge distraction. And, we saw, in fact, when President Clinton was impeached in 1998, his party gained seats that year. They were expected to lose them. And so I think the party elders have now spoken and said, we're not going to have impeachment. What bothers me is that they usually say it only in political terms. They rarely come out and say it's because he hasn't done anything to deserve impeachment. They have a hard time defining their base when it comes to President Obama. But the lawsuit, if people understand, the lawsuit is very narrow, and it has to do with the president supposedly abusing his powers when he delayed for 1 year the imposition of the employer mandate in the Affordable Care Act. Now, Republicans oppose the employer mandate. They also oppose the Affordable Care Act. But that's the grounds for their suits. It's just all very befuddling and I think counterproductive. But again, this is the world we live in today where they've decided that they're not going to pass any laws and they're not going to do any business. They're going to sue the president. That's going to be what occupies them between July and the midterm election.
I'm sure you saw Paul Krugman's piece asking the question how healthcare reform is doing. He cites, Joan, all these surveys, independent surveys from Gallup, Urban Institute, Commonwealth, all showing a sharp reduction, he writes, in the number of uninsured Americans since last fall, a striking difference between the experience in states that expand Medicaid and those that refuse to expand Medicaid. So he asked the question, which is a legitimate one, if reform appears to be working, why does it continue to poll so badly?
Because I think, not to sound shallow, but it's kind of a branding issue. And straight off the bat, going back as far as death panels and Sarah Palin in 2009, the opponents managed to jump out and define the law before Democrats and the presidents did. And I think, I was writing about it at the time. I thought it was a huge mistake. They were having a very hard time explaining what the law did. And now lots of people love parts of this law. I don't want to say all, Kathleen, because I'm not sure I can prove that, but virtually all of the component parts of the Affordable Care Act, like keeping your kids on your insurance till they're 26 if they need it, and, you know, doing away with discrimination based on pre-existing conditions and equalizing prices between men and women. All of these things pull very well individually, but when they're brought together in the rubric of Obamacare, we don't like Obamacare. And so you have this paradox of states like Kentucky, where they did their own state exchange, and it was very successful, and people love, it's called Kynect. They love Kynect, but they hate Obamacare. Mm. And so, you know, I think, and the news media has been, in my opinion, kind of irresponsible and shallow, focusing on the bad news stories. You know, the whole country stopped what it was doing in late October to check out the Affordable Care Act website because it wasn't working. And reporters, even liberal reporters, were, you know, telling their readers or their viewers, oh, my God, I went on the site and it was a disaster and it's down and it didn't do this for me. And, you know, very few of them went back to say, oh, my God, it's working really mm-hmm. well now. And, you know, people are enrolling. And I think the interesting thing about those polls, too, is that the Commonwealth one showed that people, even 74% of Republicans who've now gotten coverage under some provision of the Affordable Care Act love it. So it's really a paradox, and I think Paul Krugman put his finger on what it was about.
Joan Walsh is our guest. It's All Things Political for this Monday. We always start the week with All Things Political. She is a well-known commentator. She's a political analyst on MSNBC. She is working with Salon, where she is editor-at-large. She's an author, and she's a baseball fan. And she is a graduate of Shorewood High School and the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We are welcoming phone calls. Ken, thanks for your call and your emails. We'll get to some of the emails here in a moment. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter at K Dunn Show. Somebody pick up on the story about the races for governor and how the Republicans under the skills, really, in getting money of Governor Chris Christie have been able to get double the amount that the Democrats have. Will that make a difference in Republicans retaining seats or becoming elected in various states? We're talking about that. We again are talking about what's going on the border and a complicated situation. How can people work together to make sure that 7-year-old kids or older or younger have a place to be in this world, and what we do about uncontrolled immigration to this country. How do we handle both a humanitarian concern and a legitimate concern on the part of many that we can't take in everybody who wants to be here? How do we do it without screaming at each other and screaming at busloads of moms and children or children who are here by themselves? We're talking about that, healthcare reform, how it's doing, the Middle East, all of those issues, and we'll take as many calls as we can in the next few minutes of the show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-86. Let me combine 8655. I forgot the rest of the number. Let me read a couple Facebook comments, Joan. This one from Ryder. I've heard that many of the children at the border are also going to other Central American countries. Is this true? And if so, how are they dealing with it? And Rebecca in Milwaukee emails that we should send our troops to Mexico and South America and assist them in cleaning up their corrupt governments, thus benefiting their countries in general, and making it so these innocent people don't feel they must leave or die, which should alleviate the U.S. issues as well.
Well, I don't think anybody in this country really has a stomach to be some kind of occupying, let alone invading force in Central American countries. I don't think that there's a military solution to this problem. And there's also, you know, a lot of people want to say, oh, you know, he hasn't put enough money into border enforcement, but the real tragedy, the real, you know, the confusing tragedy of this situation, Kathleen, is that you've got kids and moms coming up to Border Patrol agents and surrendering and saying, you know, we want to be taken into detention because that's a better life than, you know, we had at home. So, you know, the situations in their home countries, some, I'm not going to deny that these are corrupt governments, but the United States has not had a really great track record of changing governments with military occupation. So I think that just makes a terrible situation even worse than you have military refugees. So.
And what do you know about, I've wondered this too, are other countries that are doing better, Costa Rica, the happiest country on earth, are Panama, are other places taking in any of these people? Do you know?
Some, but not at the numbers that we're seeing. So, you know, I just don't think there's anything comparable. There is a belief that if kids get here, they'll be able to stay. This has always been a magnet for, you know, in countries where people, you know, in times of hardship and countries where people feel threatened, you know, we've been a beacon. And, and you know, let's be honest, there's also, there are businesses of, you know, the coyotes who make money spreading lies about how easy it is to stay here and taking money from desperate people and taking their kids across. So, you know, lots of different things factoring into this.
Martha in Shorewood. Hi.
Hi. I had a question. Just this morning in the Milwaukee Journal, there was an editorial that said that people who criticize the president aren't being racist. They're just criticizing the president. And yet it's been pointed out that the level of disrespect this president, the worst president ever, et cetera, is without comparison, that everybody jumps on him and then they say that it's not racist. I'd be interested in hearing your opinion about that.
Thanks, Martha.
Well, you know, this is a tough one. I think that there's plenty of valid criticism of this president, and certainly I've criticized him myself. But I feel like there's no denying, at least for me, not for everyone, but there's no denying that there is a tenor of the criticism that is so extreme and so shrill and so hateful, and often relies on, you know, racial stereotyping that has, you know, has racial overtones. You know, I think that there, is a kind of hysteria to, some of the rhetoric. I think we've seen signs and you know, placards at Tea Party rallies depicting him as an animal and all of that. I think that, you know, electing our first black president was a kind of two steps forward, one step back thing, where it, you know, definitely woke up some people who hadn't realized how much their country had changed, and, you know, including white people, that white people had changed enough to elect Barack Obama president. But I'm also uncomfortable, you know, explaining it. I would never explain all of it in terms of racism. Bill Clinton faced an awful lot of heated invective himself. So,
thank you, Martha, for your call. Tom in Madison. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for this program. Great person to have on to this for this segment. I and I want to compliment Joan. I read her stuff in Salon all the time. It's always really great. The question I have is, why does the mainstream media, especially in Washington, D.C. and New York, lean so far to the right in a mushy kind of way, adopting a lot of the Fox talking points and other kinds of crap? You know, we're talking about why Obama takes so much heat and why Obamacare got so vilified. A lot of it has to do with how the media portrays these things or fails to question these sort of conservative and right-wing talking points. And this recent Afghanistan and Iraq thing, especially Iraq, having all of these characters on who literally were the designers of the disaster on the morning talk shows to talk about what was happening in Iraq, it gives, you know, proof to the point. I wonder what your thinking is on that, and what can we do to get the media to do their job?
Joan.
Thanks, Tom. I mean, I think, you know, something very key in getting the media to do its job is feedback. And I you know, I've seen this myself on Twitter. I think that respectfully inundating, if that's not a contradiction in terms, people, reporters, print reporters, television reporters, when they echo Republican talking points, is really crucial. And I think liberals have gotten somewhat better about that. But the pushback from the right It's 10 times as strong. I mean, it's really, when the websites of the right decide that I've said something outrageous, the number of mentions on Twitter, the number of emails, it's like night and day, the comparison. You know, I think some of it is definitely ideological, but I think reporters happen not to be terribly ideological in a lot of the cases. Some of them are lazy, but there's also, I think there's almost a refusal to acknowledge and reckon with and take in how extreme the Republican Party has become in their lifetimes. And so there's this constant kind of false equivalence. You know, you can always point to nasty slogans about George W. Bush to match one about Barack Obama, but you can't, you know, but there was never the number of people and the number of influential people saying the things that are said about the President Obama. I think it's maybe psychologically hard for them to take in the fact that the Republican Party, just take Obamacare, for the Affordable Care Act, the individual mandate was a Republican idea. The reason Republicans can't come up with an alternative to the Affordable Care Act is because Barack Obama borrowed all of their ideas. But once he did that, they had to run away from them. Immigration reform used to be at least bipartisan and somewhat Republican because people wanted, employers wanted cheaper labor. Climate change, you know, the whole cap and trade policy was a Republican policy to use a kind of private sector approach to climate change and create financial incentives for companies. Now that's socialism. I mean, on issue after issue, they've walked away from ideas that once Democrats embraced them, and they've walked farther to the right. And I find that even some mainstream media reporters that I actually respect have a really hard time taking in how far to the right the balance has shifted in the Republican Party. So that's a partial answer.
Yeah, and Tom makes an interesting point, doesn't he, that you're bringing back on some of these shows people like Dick Cheney. And it is true, and you have to, if you do any soul searching, be you Republican or Democrat or whatever, if you're a Republican, you have to take some responsibility for the fact that what led us to war didn't indeed exist. And so you have to acknowledge that, don't you, if you're Dick Cheney or one of the, because now we're in a terrible morass, and maybe it requires some self-examination of, was our policy completely correct, or was there something we did wrong? And it seems as though both sides, maybe Obama does too much of that. Maybe, though, everybody needs to learn from what happened and take responsibility for what went wrong. But that doesn't seem to happen much.
No, I mean, as we speak, in Washington, D.C., there's a big Politico, the magazine or the website Politico, is having a playbook lunch with Dick and Liz Cheney. You could be there, Kathleen, instead of talking with me. And they're laughing. They're yucking it up together. Mm. They're not treating him as, you know, with any, I'm not going to go too far on that. But, you know, Bill Kristol welcomed back by every show. There's really no... there's no accountability for being wrong on the right. And I think, you know, Tom makes a really good point, and that it's outrageous.
Yeah, you have to be accountable no matter what side you're on, it just seems to me. Quick call. I'm sorry it has to be quick. Patty in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Just a quick historical perspective on this whole children coming across the border thing. I don't know if your guest is aware, or I was not aware until recently, that in 1960 to 1962, 14,000 Cuban children came from Cuba when Castro was taking over in Cuba, because the parents of these children were afraid of communism and they thought this would be a temporary thing. So they sent their children to the U.S. And these children were basically embraced, and everyone pitched in and helped and tried to find places for these children, because we too cared about, you know, the communism entering South America. Mm-hmm. And I just think now it's just no one wants to have anything to do with it.
All right. On that note, I have to say thank you for that thought, and we will keep it in mind. Joan Walsh, we're plumb out of time, but I thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks, Kathleen. My pleasure.
Joan Walsh, our guest this hour. Joan is has for a number of years been working with Salon, where she is editor at large. You see her on MSNBC frequently as a political analyst. She's also the author of several books, including her latest, What's the Matter with White People? Finding Our Way in the Next America. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour, to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production in our studios here in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up momentarily, and we'll return with another hour calling on all teachers to tell us what you think about your jobs, hour two of our show.